Hello and welcome. You've checked into the Newport Storytellers podcast, and we are very happy that you have. This is episode 6, the final episode of Audio Delight, made possible by the support of Hobsons Bay City Council through its quick response grants. And I'm one of your hosts, Matt MacArthur.
And I'm your other host, Jackie Caron. To be clear, this Audio Delight is an assemblage, I've got better at saying that, Matt, of stories and music from Newport, Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, west side of the Yarra River or Birrarung, the River of Mists.
Newport fosters a thriving community of musicians and storytellers who practice the art of the raconteur, the reciter of verse, the folk and fairy tale, or as we sometimes say, the said, not read, or the spoken word.
And over the years, we've recorded many of the storytellers, and in the light of our lives being upended in 2020, it seemed like the right time to release some of the tales into the universe. After all, we all love a story and a song. And Matt, I'm feeling a bit sad, as this is our last episode in the series. It's been a learning experience and a lot of fun mucking around with mics, trawling through the archives, bumbling our way through interviews and dancing with technology. Maybe that bit wasn't as fun as I'm thinking it was. Anyway, having said that, there is always the possibility of a special episode every so often.
Absolutely. Now I've got the hang of this editing thing, the occasional special episode into the future is definitely on the agenda.
Well, that's good to know, Matt. So, as I've asked in every episode, what's the plan for this one?
The plan. The plan, Jackie, is, as it has been from the start, to celebrate the storytelling and music making in the local community, and through this audio window, invite those beyond to enjoy our shenanigans, or to put it simply, to make something of niceness. As always, we have two stories, and between the stories, our musical advisor, Alan Davies, has an interview and song for us from a member of the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club. And of course, we have other delights from our audio treasure trove. And we always close with a lullaby. However, before we begin, in every episode, we've taken a moment to explore something about Newport. And by the time we recorded this episode, the worst of the COVID restrictions had been lifted and we could meet face to face and go exploring together.
Which is exactly what we did. As we said in the intro, Newport is situated on the west side of the Birrarung or Yarra River, where it flows into the bay. The Westgate Bridge connects east and west, daily carrying thousands and thousands of cars and trucks. However, there was a time when there was no bridge, and the journey was more complicated, so we set off on a history hunt to learn something of the story of the Williamstown car ferry and to find the location of the old jetty. We departed from my house, which is just across from the Newport Power Station, the image of which you see when you search for this podcast. So here it is, the car ferry, something about Newport in a nutshell. Okay, Matt, for the benefit of those listening, we're sitting on my front porch about to head off to the mouth of the river and look for the place where the car ferry used to pull in. You've got the recording gadget and a copy of the notes. I'll lead because this is my patch and I know the way. But first things first, do you think you could read that bit from the top of the notes?
I can indeed. Before the Westgate Bridge was built, if you wanted to cross the river from the city side to Newport, you had two choices. You could go the long road or the short road. The long road was down Dynon Road to Whitehall Street and then along Douglas Parade. The short road involved using the Williamstown car ferry that went from the end of Williamstown Road and crossed the Yarra to the Strand, to a jetty near the power station.
Okay, so we begin by walking to the end of my street, crossing Douglas Parade and navigating our way across the park.
Let's do this.
Come on then.
So we're just coming to the water's edge. You know this area better than me, Jackie. Were we near where the ferry landing was?
Look, Matt, I stared at photos online until my eyes were red, trying to pinpoint the exact spot. And then I just happened to meet an old-timer who told me to look for two old palm trees. And then he reckons that to the left of them, we'd see evidence of some kind of construction. And he reckons that's the spot.
Well,
two palm trees just over there. Let's go have a look.
Let's have a look here.
So we're standing by the palms, and one's looking pretty good, but the other's lost its top. Seen better days. And to the left is the HMAS Yarra Memorial Jetty. And that means, according to your source, that this is the place where the car ferry used to pull in. And if not, we're very close.
Well, so much has been done shoring up the banks of this river with volcanic boulders. We're looking at a river that has been turned over to the services of industry. Back to the task at hand. While searching for images online, I stumbled on some footage of the ferry taken in 1963, and I reckon it is absolutely worth a gander. You really get a good look at the old power station in the background, and you can see how the ferry, it was an old coal burner, and you can see the two heavy chains that sunk to the bottom of the river guided it across. And apparently it could carry about 25 cars at a time. So I'm going to post that link to our podcast page. So what else do the notes tell us, Matt?
Well, this came off a blog called Historic Trucks, and it seems like the author, a history librarian who we can only know as Heather, is across the subject. Heather writes, "People used this location to cross the river from the time Melbourne was established up until the first formalised ferry service started in 1873. In 1873, a foot passenger paid onepence, vehicle with one horse or animal, sixpence, and with two horses or animals, ninepence, with three animals, 1 shilling. Vehicles with four wheels, 2 shillings. The ferry became redundant with the opening of the Westgate Bridge in 1978. We'll make the link to this blog available as well.
There's quite a bit of action out there, being a hot night. There's a big container vessel coming up. Would that pilot ship have been out working with that one?
The boat that we just saw pass is a tug.
Oh, okay.
And it will be anticipating the container vessel coming into the Swanson dock.
So from here, and looking north up the river, we can see the Westgate Bridge. It was 1967 when the work began, and all was going well until October the 15th, 1970, when a large span collapsed, causing the death of 35 men, and to this day, Australia's worst industrial accident. Now, the tragedy of this accident is still with us. People still talk about it. The bridge was eventually completed, and with the opening on November the 15th, 1978, the ferry became redundant. Did you ever cross on the car ferry, Matt?
I don't remember being on the car ferry, but I use the punt on a regular basis.
The little punt up closer to the river where you can take your bike?
Almost under the span of the bridge, and yes, yeah, it's only really worth my while taking it with the bike.
Yeah.
It's not great public transport options on the far side.
Yeah, when Zoe was little, we used to go over the punt and go riding around on the other side of the river. I think I've got a memory of crossing on the ferry, but I'm not entirely sure it's a real memory or someone else's memory that's kind of worked its way into my head.
Wasn't it nice to finally be able to go exploring and record something together?
It was, Jackie. Very fun. But now it's time for our first story, and I've chosen one of Mary O'Mara's. Mary grew up in West Footscray, and her stories take us back in time and often revolve around her Irish-Australian family life. The eldest of 6 children, 4 girls and 2 boys, her parents were determined that all of their children would receive a good secondary and possibly tertiary education. No mean feat back then, as it was customary for many girls to leave school at 14. With a large extended family, it was quite natural to recount personal stories when they caught up with each other. Mary can't imagine being without stories. She believes they are a vital part of our lives, regardless of our background. Stories allow us to unlock the imagination, travel the world, laugh, cry, and find meaning in our lives. And she dedicates this story to her mum, Kathleen, and her 2 grandmothers, Maggie and Kitty, her first storytellers.
Okay, this is a work in progress. It's another family story of which I have an absolute abundant wealth. So you can imagine living in a household with five siblings, three of whom are girls, was quite an interesting affair, especially when you're the oldest and you can sort of oversee what's going on, and you've been there the longest, so you've got the greatest load of stories. Anyway, this particular one is, as I said, a work in progress, but it's also about a very tumultuous part of my life, for the simple, not just my life, but my sister's lives too. We had a tendency in our family to borrow each other's clothes. Now, sometimes that worked if they were short for me, like if it was a top, because the other three were all taller than me. So I couldn't wear anything that was pants or a dress because it would be, you know, I'd look as though I was walking along the floor. And over a period of time, there were certain unwritten laws that developed with all this. One was that if one of us brought an article of clothing into the house, brand new, it had to be worn at least four or five times before anyone borrowed it. The other law was that you did not borrow without asking first. Now, they were very, very strictly adhered to, most of the time. So, on one occasion, my sister borrowed, one of my next sister in line borrowed a burgundy velvet ball dress, ball gown that I had made. I had stitched it myself. She borrowed it and went out with it. And when she came home, it had a big stain down the front. So that caused umpteen rows, and mainly on my part, because it took me so long to get this dress made. Anyway, 2 weeks later, I borrowed an outfit of hers, a skirt and a jacket, which she had made at school and wasn't supposed to be wearing, but she had. And she loaned it to me. I didn't know she wasn't supposed to be wearing it. So I went away for the weekend, packed everything very neatly in a small case. When I came back, a bottle of perfume had broken and stained all the front of this outfit, which she wasn't supposed to be wearing, and had to give a reason for it when she took it back to school for marking. Anyway, on one particular occasion, this same sister Colleen, everything seemed to, a lot of the trouble seemed to revolve around Colleen, but this time she was on the receiving end. She had bought a brand new, beautiful Angora sweater, just perfect. And you know, when Angora's new, it's very soft, and the colour is just magnificent. So she went out on Saturday night, came home very, very late, and was in bed asleep in the morning. My third sister Judy got up and wanted to borrow this jumper of Colleen's. And she kept at Mum and at Mum, and Mum said in the end, "Oh, all right, but you know, what if she wakes up before you borrow it?" She said, "I'm not going to be very long. I'm only going to church for an hour," and we lived across the road from the church. So Mum said, "All right, but don't you go and get it. I'll go and get it." So she sneaked into the bedroom, opened up the door, then opened the wardrobe, took this jumper out, and Colleen's still dead to the world. She came in and gave it to Judy. Judy very quickly put it on and was out the door. This was at about 9:30 in the morning. 10:20, when Mum was sitting in the kitchen having a cup of tea, Colleen got up, came out into the kitchen, sat down and was eating her breakfast. And Mum said, "Why are you up so early?" "Oh, I'm going out with my friends and I needed to get up earlier than I usually do because, you know, we have to have a fair way to go." So anyway, Mum immediately began to worry. Judy was going to be walking back in the door very soon, and she was going to be wearing Colleen's jumper. So Mum walked around, pretending to go into the bedroom, and as she did, she closed the door to keep the warmth, supposedly, in the kitchen. She stood looking out the window and saw Judy come across the road in his jumper. She went quickly to the door and opened it so that Colleen wouldn't hear Judy coming in. She took her straight into the bedroom and said to her, "Here, I've found something else for you to put on. Give me that jumper quickly. Colleen is up. She's going to wonder why it's not where it should be." So Judy put the jumper on, came out, walked into the kitchen, spoke to Colleen as though everything was normal. Mum, meanwhile, had gone from the bedroom and put this jumper in the hall cupboard. By this stage, Judy had now finished her breakfast, so she wanted to go and get ready. And she walked into the bedroom and came out again, and she said to Mum, "I was going to wear that new jumper that I bought last week, but I can't find it. Have you seen it?" "No," Mum said, "no, not at all. I don't know where it could be. Have you had a look in the cupboard in the hallway?" This cupboard in the hallway, I have to tell you, was supposed to be a linen cupboard, but it just finished up accommodating everything that nobody could find where else to put it. It went into the linen cupboard. So Colleen went and had a look in this linen cupboard and found, shock horror, her jumper. And she said to Mum, "But how did it get in there? I didn't put it in there. You know, how has that got there?" Mum said, "Oh, I don't know, you know, looking very blasé, I don't know." "Well, you found it now anyway." So Colleen went and had a shower, got dressed, came out, and as she came out, she said to Mum, "What really happened with my jumper? When I put it on, it was still warm."
Thank you, Mary. I've enjoyed your stories on numerous occasions, and this is one of my favourites. So, Jackie, it's time to hear from our music scout and advisor, Alan Davies, from the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club, whose task it is to showcase a club individual or band.
And he has sent us a super special interview and song. For our final singer-songwriter of the series, we have something a bit different. This song is a collaboration between Dharma Picking and her 7-year-old niece, Matilda Propone. Dharma will be familiar to our listeners from past episodes, but this is a first for her. Matilda wrote some lyrics and asked Dharma to put them to music. The result is a song called Through the Door. Here they are in conversation with Alan Davies.
I'm talking to Dharma Picking and Matilda Propone, and together they've written a song called Through the Door. And Matilda, I'm going to start with you because you wrote the words. The song's about another world. What gave you the idea to write a song about another world?
Well, I guess it just popped into my head as I was thinking about it, and then I just wrote it down, and I told my friend to, like, make a song, write a song now, and that starts with Through the Door, because I thought it was a really nice idea.
And it seems like it's a nice world that's quiet and beautiful. It sounds like it's a place that you would like to be.
Yeah, it's actually a quite nice place. As I see it in my mind, it's actually very nice.
You say that you see it in your mind, and when you wrote down the description of it, did you think, yeah, that's it, that's exactly how I see it?
Well, I would have said the first part. I saw it because of, as you walk on, you get to a different part where all the grass and there's just big cliffs and that.
Did the song turn out the way you wanted it to, or do you still feel like you didn't quite get what's in your mind down into words?
I like the song. I think that the way I see it, I think the words actually describe it. When I was writing it, when I sang it to myself, there was like one chunk and there was like, it was in tune, and then there was another chunk, but it was like kind of off tune from that, so you had to change tunes a lot, and I didn't like the tune, but I liked the words.
So when you were writing it, you were already singing it to yourself. You knew it was a song and not a poem.
Yeah.
Oh, you never sang me the tune. I don't know what the tune was.
Well, when I was just singing the song randomly, like
that's normal. Probably why the words fitted so well into a song, because you were writing them in a melody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. Yeah, you actually had a tune in your head. And I think you said before that you liked the words, but you didn't really like the tune.
Yeah.
So I guess that's why you gave it to Dharma.
Yeah.
How did you feel when you first heard Dharma sing your words as a song?
Well, when she first showed me, I felt excited. And when she showed me, I loved it. And then when she first said, when people first heard it, I got nervous and excited.
Do you think you'll write more?
Yes.
All right, let's move on to you, Dharma. Matilda gave you some lyrics and said, hey, can you make a song out of this? What were the really strong ideas or feelings in the song that helped you come up with a melody for it?
Well, I was taken aback by the words, and it was a pleasure to write the music to it. I felt wistful and, well, like it was floating. I felt it was a lot of reflection and calm, and I wanted the melody to sort of suit that. So the essence of the words.
Mm. Are there special challenges that go along with putting someone else's words into music?
Well, it's the first time I've done it. I've written a few songs myself, but I haven't used someone else's words. And the words were so easy to use. Though Matilda did, when she gave me 24 hours to write it, I had to perform it to her band. And her band are a lot of 6 and 7 year olds.
A nine-year-old
who don't play instruments yet. So I wanted to choose nice simple chords, that was the bass, and just make it as simple as possible.
Through the door I go into a world where no one's been before, where the flowers grow, oceans are full of peace, and Eugen hears the breeze. I've been spending all my hours trying to get home. Every step and every hour is hurting. I'm not afraid to be alone. Come and find me in this other world. Come and find me in this other world. Through the door I go into a world where no one's been before, where the flowers grow, oceans are full of peace, and I can hear the breeze. I've been spending all my hours trying to get home. Every step and every hour is hurting. I am not afraid to be alone. Come and find me in this other world. Come and find me in this other world. Come and find me in this other world.
That was Dharma Picking singing Through the Door, with lyrics by 7-year-old Matilda Propone. Thank you, Alan. Now, I know we say this every episode, but we will keep repeating. Please visit the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club website at nffc.org.au and go for a virtual wander. There's much to enjoy. It's never too late to learn an instrument or to sing or tell stories, and if doing these things is not your thing, the club welcomes volunteers and those who like to listen. So, Jackie, story number 2. This is one you chose. Tell us more.
Well, not quite yet, Matt. Here's the thing. In episode 3, I made mention of the Newport Bush Orchestra and I promised to return to the subject. I have a deep affection for the orchestra. The idea of keeping tunes alive by playing them touches my heart. Many of the orchestra have had little or no musical training and have learned the tunes by ear. People can read about the orchestra on the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club website and listen to an interview with the founder, Greg O'Leary. In 2012, the orchestra recorded a CD, and I've chosen to share track 12, Helen's Heart Waltz by Helen McKay. Greg had this to say about Helen's tune. I have been playing for many years, and of all the tune types, waltzes are the hardest to compose. As hard as one tries, fragments from other waltzes creep in, and soon you find that your tune is not really yours. Helen's Heart Waltz sounds like many other waltzes, but it isn't. She cracked it for the right mix of originality and familiarity that makes for a good new tune in a particular style. So this is an Australian waltz written by an Australian in the 21st century. Great stuff. How sweet is that? Greg O'Leary sent us some background on Helen. Would you like to read it for us, Matt?
Sure. Helen and Greg met in 2002 when the Victorian Folk Club commissioned him to lead a tunes workshop featuring collected Australian fiddle tunes. This was held at the Hibbs residence in Ringwood East, and Helen was an original member. At the time, she was a nurse at the local hospital and a member of the Army Reserve. She drove massive trucks and secretly hankered to be a truckie. She'd studied violin at school and, like so many others, couldn't find a use for her moderate skills and let them lapse, until she saw an article in the local rag about the Bush Orchestra. Helen took to the genre well and, as hoped, joined the Ringwood Folk Club as well. Helen went to England about 12 years ago for a change, met a Welsh chap and got married. She recently returned to Oz and is living in Warrnambool with her family. Jackie, I'm glad you followed up the Bush Orchestra, and thanks Greg for sending us some of Helen's story to share. But now it's time for our last story in the series. What have you chosen?
Well, this was a special request from me. I wanted our listeners to hear Alan tell a story. We've heard him interview our musicians and listen to the Newport Community Choir, which he conducts, but he's also a gifted storyteller. I heard Alan tell this story a few years ago on a night when we weren't recording, and this happens sometimes, so I asked him if he could record it for us, and here it is. Enjoy.
This is the story of the shortest camping trip I've ever done. Why was it so short? I'll tell you. This was in January 2003, and I planned a short camping trip to a place called Lurdadur Gorge with my son Hugh, who was 7. The plan was to walk up the gorge from the entrance near Bacchus Marsh. It's less than an hour's walk, and you get to a big waterhole. Then if you walk another 10 minutes up the gorge, there's a little waterhole. Just enough room to pitch a tent. Nice shade from a tree. Beautiful little spot. So we packed up all the camping gear, had the packs ready to go, got up in the morning. Hugh says he's feeling sick. Okay, we won't go, but I left the gear packed just in case. Then, in the afternoon, he said, oh, I'm feeling better now. So I thought, we'll go anyway. We got to the waterhole about 5:30. Everything went according to plan. We set up camp, had a swim, cooked dinner, sat around the fire. Beautiful. I woke up at 6 a.m. the next morning to the smell of smoke. When I put my head out of the tent, I could see that the gorge was full of smoke and that the trees above me on the spur were being blown around like crazy by the gusty, hot northerly wind. And I thought of other walks I'd done in the gorge. Long stretches through trees blackened by bushfires. I thought of the piece of glass I picked up on another walk, which I still have, melted into a twisted shape by the heat of a bushfire. I knew we had to get out of there. I woke up Hugh, he's not a morning person, and we packed up the tent, shoved everything into our packs, and set off down the river. And now that we were walking, with the wind and the fire behind us, seeing only the bush and not the familiar artifacts of camping, it was like millions of years of evolution dropped away, and I became a frightened animal in the bush, with the hot breath of a fearful beast at my back. And along with fear came another ancient instinct, the parental instinct to protect your child. The need to protect my little 7-year-old boy, walking calmly at my side, animated every muscle and nerve in my body. I knew that if I showed fear, he would be afraid too. So I stayed calm. We talked about ordinary things. We didn't rush. We walked at a normal pace. But my mind was racing. Every once in a while, not so often as to make it obvious, I looked over my shoulder. Any moment, the fire could roar over the spur. If it did, I knew our only hope was to get down to the river. The track we are on is sometimes close to the river, sometimes it climbs up to avoid rocky bluffs. Every step along the way, I had my eye on the terrain, calculating the shortest path to the river if the beast came upon us. After about 45 minutes of walking, we got back to the car, put our packs in the back, and drove out. Still at normal pace, no rushing. On the way home, I put on the radio and found that the smoke was from bushfires hundreds of kilometres away. We'd never been in any danger. When I tell this story in casual conversation, it's about what a fool I was. If the fire was close, there would have been a lot more signs of it than just a bit of smoke. And why didn't I take a little pocket radio to get the news? But out there in the bush, I didn't feel foolish. I felt strong, and I felt in touch with my deepest instincts. I escaped the monster, and I protected my little boy.
Thank you for your story, Alan, and thank you for selecting the songs and interviewing the musicians for us and for helping us with a web page and all the wonderful things you do to strengthen our community through music.
And so it's time for our final lullaby. Well, I'm calling it a lullaby, although I believe it's usually described as a lament. It's called Bovigli's Plaid, and it's written for violin by James Scott Skinner, 1843 to 1927. Skinner was a violinist and dancing master of great skill. Apparently, when Queen Victoria learned of his reputation, she requested him to teach calisthenics and dancing to the royal household at Balmoral. The title, Bovigley's Plaid, is from a description of Queen Victoria's of a location at Bovigley, thought to be near Crathy, in Deeside, in which a belt of trees seemed to her to stand in the shape of a plaid, or tartan. We've put a link on the podcast page to Skinner's manuscript for the violinists who are listening in. Our musician is Sarah DePasquale.
Thank you to the wondrous Sarah. Sarah moved to Melbourne from Adelaide with her pianist husband Bernard several years ago. For almost 30 years they worked together as the Tea Rose Duo, finding a special place in the heart of South Australians. Sarah joined the Newport Villain Folk Club and that's where we met, and so began our collaboration, working with music and story.
So this brings us to the end of episode 6 and to the end of this series of the Newport Storytellers podcast. Thank you for listening. It's been a blast working on this project, and hopefully you've enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed making it. It's a goodbye from me, Matt MacArthur.
And I'd like to add to that, Matt, it has been a blast sieving through the stories, working with Alan, and digging out a little of the history of Newport. So it's a goodbye from me too, Jackie Caron.
Jackie and I acknowledge that recording and editing of this podcast has taken place on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unbroken connection to country that has long been mapped by story, song and dance, and we pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and to the elders of all nations and to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders who have been listening to this podcast.
We thank the Newport Fiddlin Folk Club, under whose auspice we bloom, Hobsons Bay Library and the Williamstown Literary Festival, who've made space for our voices, and all the storytellers and musicians who've given their permission for us to share their work. For more information on the music, the musicians, your hosts, me, Jackie and Alan, and the storytellers, visit our page on the Newport Fiddlin Folk Club website, nffc.org.au. The Newport Storytellers podcast is recorded using the closest piece of technology to hand, edited by Matt MacArthur. Mary O'Mara's story was recorded by Matt at the Newport Hub and Sarah DePasquale by Kerry Saxby at the Melbourne Theatre Company Studios. Thank you, Bruce Williams, for our theme and Cameron Sharp for our graphic.
All the people in this podcast have contributed to events produced in Newport and the City of Hobsons Bay under the banners of Storytelling Australia Victoria and the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club. Not all the storytellers live in the local area. Several travel from distant suburbs and even nearby regional towns to join us. Please, if you've enjoyed listening, spread the word. Stories and music are for sharing.
Well, Matt, what a day it has been. Who would have thought recording episode 6 would be such a technological challenge?
Zencastr changed its back end, Firefox ran off with its tail between its legs, and Chrome spat the dummy.
But finally, we got to sit in the same room and record, so all's well that ends well.